Om sahana vavatu, sahana bhunaktu, saha viryan karavavahai, tejasvi navadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om. Good. Welcome to you. Welcome to our webcast of our Saturday morning class on Shankaracharya's Atma Bodha. We continue today with verse 56. We'll begin. The topic is knowledge of Brahman. And to introduce the verse very briefly, Brahman is Nirguna. Nirguna Brahman is the ultimate truth, absolute reality. Guna means quality. So the obvious question is, how can Brahman be known if Brahman has no qualities? We know everything else through their qualities. So we say that this cloth is made of threads. Threads is one quality. Color, orange, is another quality. If this cloth had no qualities whatsoever, how would you describe it? How could you know it? So knowledge comes through knowing qualities and attributes. Brahman has no qualities, no attributes. Therefore, at one level, Brahman is unknowable. And it's true. Brahman is unknowable as an object. Note that very, very clearly. Brahman is indeed unknowable as an object, but Brahman is knowable in another way, which this next verse will demonstrate. You can repeat after me. Atad vyavritti rupena, atad vyavritti rupena, Vedantar lakshyate dvayam, Vedantar lakshyate dvayam, akhanda nandam ekam yata, akhanda nandam ekam yata, tad brahmetyavadharayet, tad brahmetyavadharayet. You'll remember that last line from our prior classes, which is like a refrain that comes, not in every verse in this section, but in many verses in this section. Tad brahma iti. Tad brahma, that is Brahman. Iti thus avadharayet. Thus it should be ascertained. Thus you should understand. And what is that Brahman that should be realized? Shankara says, it is known how to ascertain that Brahman, how to realize that Brahman, how to know that Brahman. And Shankara says, atad vyavritti rupena vedantaihi lakshyate advayam. The of advayam got lost due to rules of Sandhi. Advayam, that non-dual Brahman, lakshyate, is taught, is indicated, is shown, Vedantaihi, by the teachings of Vedanta. The teachings of Vedanta, teach you the nature of that non-dual Brahman. How, first line, atad vyavritti rupena, through a method. Rupa here refers to a method of teaching. A method of teaching which is vyavritti. Vyavritti means negation. And negation of what? Atat. Whatever is not that. Through a process of negating all that is not Brahman, Brahman is taught by the teachings of Vedanta. That's quite a literal translation of the first two lines of this verse. Needs to be understood very clearly, of course. So through a process of negation, Brahman is taught. We use negation not just as one of our tools in teaching Vedanta, but as the main tool. Negation, and it makes sense because Brahman, you can't say, you can say the cloth is made of cotton, you can say the cloth is made of threads, you can say the cloth is orange, but what can you say about Brahman? So instead of defining Brahman positively through words of assertion, Vedanta leads you to discover Brahman through words of negation. Atat vyavritti. The vyavritti, negation of atat, that which is not that, that which is not Brahman. And this process of negation is brilliantly explained by one of my favorite metaphors, drishtantas. Shankara doesn't specifically refer to that drishtanta here, but he implies it. It's so famous, it has a special name. Arundhati Darshana Nyaya. Here Nyaya means a metaphor. A Nyaya, which is based on the Darshana, the seeing of Arundhati. Arundhati is the name of a star, and you need to know the context in order to understand this metaphor. The context is a traditional Hindu wedding. The wedding will go on for 3 or 4 days. Towards the end of the wedding, after the main ceremonies have been completed, the priest takes the bride, the newly married bride and groom, are taken outside, and this is at nighttime. The priest takes them outside, and in part of a ritual, the priest makes them look at a particular star. It's actually a double star. Some stars they look like one star, but if you look through a telescope, you see that there are two. So this star called Arundhati here is actually a double star. One star is Arundhati, and the other star is Vasishta. Some of you may know that the sage Vasishta was married to Arundhati, and their marriage is often held up as an ideal marriage. They were inseparable. So just as the sage Vasishta and his wife Arundhati were inseparable, and just as those two stars, Vasishta and Arundhati, the stars are inseparably connected, the priest makes the newly married couple look at this star so to bless them that their marriage also, they should also be inseparably connected. Now, the way the metaphor works, though, is how does the priest make them look at this particular star? They can't just look at the stars in general. They have to look at that particular star. If the star, if the priest just says, look, if the priest speaks Hindi, you'll say, hey, dekho, tar dekho, look at the star. And the priest has to point out the particular star. And the way the priest does so is by leading them through a process. In fact, the priest will start by pointing to a tree. You say, vo vriksh dekho. Look at that tree. I don't know if you use vriksh or paired, whatever you call a tree. Look at that tree, he says. Do you see the tree? The priest asks the couple. You say, yes, we see the tree. Then the priest says, do you see the branch on the lower right side of the tree? Yes, we see the branch. Do you see the fork in the branch of that tree? Yes, we see the fork. Do you see the star in the fork of the branch of the tree? They say, yes, we see that star. And the priest says, that's not Arundhati. But then the priest continues, says, look a little further to the right and up. Do you see that really bright star? Yes, we see that star. The priest says, but that's not Arundhati. But look further right and a little bit further up. Do you see the dimmer star? Yes. That's not Arundhati. But look here, and they go through this process several times. The priest keeps leading them from one star to another. Each time, he negates the star and then leads them towards another star. It's a process of negation that ultimately leads the newly married couple to see the particular star called Arundhati. It's a wonderful example because it uses a process of negation to lead them to discover that particular star. And this is so appropriate with regard to knowledge of Brahman. Consider this. When they look up at the sky for the very first time, this is a tricky question. They're looking at all the stars. Do they see Arundhati or not? They do. Arundhati is one of the thousands of stars they see. They see Arundhati in general, but they don't see the particular star that's Arundhati. In the same way, everything you experience is a manifestation of Brahman. Can you say Brahman is completely unknown since Brahman is present in everything you experience? You can't say that. Brahman is known in general. Just like when they look up at the sky, Arundhati is known in general, but they need this methodology to see Arundhati in particular. In the same way, Brahman is known in general as a reality because of which everything exists. But in order to know exactly and particularly what is that Brahman, this methodology of negation is required. Through a process of negation, you're led to discover that Brahman. But there's a problem here. I've mentioned before, every metaphor has a limitation. Every metaphor has a problem. If a metaphor were perfect, it wouldn't be a metaphor, it would be the actual thing. Here, the problem is, how can negation and negation alone lead you to gain knowledge of Brahman? The defect of the metaphor is they're experiencing particular stars outside. They're looking at one star and another star and another star. That's not how we understand Brahman. The process of negation is not that Brahman is not an elephant. Look at that. If you start to negate, Brahman is not an elephant. Brahman is not a cow. Brahman is not a car. Brahman is not a house. How will that ever culminate in knowledge of Brahman? Well, there are two factors here. One factor is the example I just gave was random negation. Random negation is useless. Just like if they're looking out at the stars, the priest isn't going to say, look over there, that is not Arundhati. Look over there, that is not Arundhati. It's not a random process of negation. It's a highly sophisticated process of negation. But the more important difference is this. Pure negation cannot lead you to knowledge of Brahman unless the Brahman you're gaining knowledge of is already present in your experience, just as that star they're looking for is already present in their experience, but not recognized for what it truly is. In the same way, Brahman is already present in your experience, but not recognized for what it truly is. You might wonder, what do you mean? Brahman is already present in my experience? Yes. It's present in your experience as your own consciousness. The consciousness by which you know what's happening right now, the consciousness by which you know that I'm sitting here and teaching you, the consciousness by which you know what's happening in your mind and what's happening around you in the room, that consciousness which is present in all of your experiences, that consciousness is Brahman. That consciousness which is always present in your experience is discovered to be Brahman. I said before, Brahman cannot be known as an object. Watch this very carefully. Brahman can never be known as an object. Brahman can be known as yourself, as your own true nature. In fact, the only way that Brahman can be known is as your own true nature. Excuse me. And that's what Shankara says in the next line. So that first half, that Brahman, which is taught by Vedanta through a process of negation, that Brahman is what? In the third line, akanda anandam ekam yata. That Brahman is yet, that which is ekam, one what? Akanda ananda. Ananda, usually mistranslated as bliss, I've translated here as fullness, and akanda, partless, limitless, endless, vast. Akanda ananda, limitless, vast, fullness, not bliss. And this we've talked about this before, but it's a good time to re-emphasize. It's incorrect. Words have many meanings. Ananda does mean bliss in some contexts, but here it cannot mean bliss, because bliss is what you experience. Whatever you experience is transient, comes and goes. Here we're talking about Brahman. Brahman is not a transient experience. So to translate ananda as bliss turns Brahman into an object of experience. Brahman is neither an object, nor is Brahman something you can experience. Brahman is your true nature as Satchidananda Atma, that unborn, unchanging consciousness. So tad brahma iti avadharayet, you should understand that Brahman in this way. Iti avadharayet, you should understand Brahman in this way. In what manner? As akanda ananda, as your innate, limitless fullness. In fact, nicely, the very next verse is going to show us why translating ananda as bliss is incorrect. And Shankara just makes it very clear in the next verse. Let's see that. Akanda nanda rupasya, akanda nanda rupasya, tasya nanda lavashataha. Tasya nanda lavashataha brahmadhyastaratam yena, brahmadhyastaratam yena bhavantyanandino khilaha, bhavantyanandino khilaha. Start in the third line. Brahma Adyaha. Brahma here is Brahmaji, the God as creator. So, and Adyaha is plural for etc. So referring to gods like Brahman. Brahma etc. Brahmadyaha. Gods like Brahmaji. What about those gods? They are ashrataha, in the end of the second line. Ashrataha, they depend on, and you can see the preceding word ananda. So they depend on ananda, they enjoy ananda. Literally, they depend on ananda, but in context, you might say, gods like Brahman enjoy or experience ananda. What kind of ananda do they experience? They experience ananda lava. Lava means a small bit, a particle. just a hint. So the gods like Brahman are ananda lavashataha. They are dependent on their experience of just this lava, this tiny little particle of ananda. Of what kind of ananda? Tasya ananda. They experience just a little bit of tasya ananda, of that ananda. Of what ananda? First line, akanda ananda rupasya. So prior verse used that term, akanda ananda, limitless fullness. So here, the Shankaracharya is saying, gods like Brahman experience bliss, and I'm using that word very intentionally here. They experience bliss, but the bliss they experience is not Brahman. The bliss they experience is just a lava, just a little particle of ananda, the ananda, which is akanda ananda, which is that limitless fullness of Brahman. This needs to be explained. Shankara is saying, gods like Brahman enjoy bliss, but the bliss they enjoy is just the tiniest part of what is truly Brahmananda, that limitless Brahmananda, akanda ananda. And the reason for that is whatever is experienced, this is fundamental Vedanta, whatever you experience is in the form of a vritti in your mind, a mental event. All experiences take place in your mind. All experiences in the mind are vrittis, mental events. And as a mental event, they're limited by the nature of the mind. Consciousness, look at this. Consciousness is vast, limitless, all-pervasive. But that vast, limitless, all-pervasive consciousness manifest in your mind is not vast and limitless. In our experience of consciousness in our mind is finite, limited. Even though consciousness is limitless, the limitless consciousness manifest in your mind is limited due to the nature of the mind. And just to go back to our famous metaphor, by the way, we're not talking about clay pot right now, but we're talking about pot space. We use the pot in two ways. One way is a relationship between clay and pot, but that's not our point right now. Here, our discussion is about limitless space and pot space. We've used that metaphor also. Limitless space is present in this pot in a limited form. I'll say that again. Limitless space is present in this pot in a limited form. In the same way, all pervasive consciousness is manifest in your mind in a limited form. And coming back to our verse, akanda ananda, limitless fullness, is manifest in your mind as limited bliss. I'll say that again. Akanda ananda, limitless fullness, becomes manifest in your mind as a limited experience of bliss. Just as all pervasive consciousness is manifest in your mind in a limited way, in the same way, akanda ananda, limitless fullness, is manifest in your mind in a limited way. That's our experience of bliss. And whatever bliss we experience is definitely limited because it comes and goes. That's true not only for you and me, it's even true for gods like Brahma. So Brahmaji has a mind, and in his mind, akanda ananda, limitless fullness, is manifest in the mind of Brahmaji. But because Brahmaji's mind is limited, the manifestation of that Akhandananda, limitless fullness, it becomes limited by mind. Shankara in the second half connects this to a very famous passage in the Taittiriya Upanishad, one of our important Upanishads. In the second half, Shankara goes on to say that Brahmadyaha, in the third line, those gods like Brahman, they, in the final line, Bhavanti, they Akhilaha, all of them. Brahmadyaha, gods like Brahman, Akhilaha, all of those gods like Brahman, Anandinaha Bhavanti, they become happy, fulfilled, possessed of ananda, they gain ananda, taratamyena, respectively. Respectively means according to the level of the god, according to the level of the deity, they become endowed with ananda to a particular degree. This idea of degrees of ananda is taught in this very famous passage in the Taittiriya Upanishad. This passage is called Ananda Mimamsa. Mimamsa means an analysis of different kinds of ananda. And I'm going to paraphrase. It's quite lengthy, but let me paraphrase it. If you haven't heard this, you'll find it very fascinating. The Upanishad begins by defining a basic unit of ananda. Seriously, a basic unit of ananda, which is the ananda enjoyed by a young, healthy, educated person. That one unit of ananda is called manusha ananda, the ananda of a person. That's one unit of ananda. But then, so there are other beings who enjoy more ananda because their minds are less limited. So a human being has a very limited mind and therefore enjoys limited ananda. But what about manushya gandharva? That's another category of being. Gandharva, a celestial being, who's of a category, manushya gandharva, a human-like celestial being. And the text says that the manushya gandharva, the human-like celestial being, experiences teye shatam, 100 times as much ananda. So if that one unit of ananda enjoyed by a young, healthy, educated person, if that's one unit, then these beings called manushya gandharvas enjoy 100 times more ananda. But then there's another category of being called deva gandharva. So gandharva, celestial beings who are more like gods than people, they experience 100 times more than that. And then there's another category of being called pitras, pitra ancestors. The ancestors who are Chiraloka, who dwell eternally in the heavens, the ancestors enjoy 100 times more ananda than that. This is taratamya. These are relative degrees of ananda. So we start with one unit of ananda enjoyed by a manusha times 100 is the ananda experienced by a manusha gandharva, a human-like celestial being. 100 times that is the ananda experienced by a deva gandharva. And 100 times that is the ananda experienced by the pitras, the ancestors. And 100 times that is the ananda experienced by the ajana devas, The gods who are born into heaven experience 100 times more ananda than the others. And then there's yet another category of devas called karma deva, the devas who get born into heaven because of the rituals. Karma here means rituals, because of the rituals they performed when they were as human beings. So those karma devas enjoy 100 times more bliss than the ajana devas. And then there's another category of devas. Devas like Agni and Surya and Vayu, they enjoy 100 times more ananda than that. But then, of course, Indra is the king of the gods. So Indra enjoys 100 times more ananda than the other devas. Then there is the ananda enjoyed by Brihaspati. Brihaspati is the guru of the gods, the priest of in heaven. So Brihaspati enjoys 100 times more ananda than even Indra. And then the text, we're coming towards the end now, then 100 times more than that is the ananda enjoyed by Prajapati. Here Prajapati means Virat. Virat is Ishvara, identified with the entire physical universe, an aspect of Ishvara, enjoys 100 times more ananda than that. And then one more step is the ananda enjoyed by, it says Brahmanaha in the text, and it refers to Hiranyagarbha. I don't want to go into all the details here. Hiranyagarbha is Ishvara, identified with the entire subtle universe. Ishvara's ananda is 100 times more than that. Here we have this taratamya, relative degrees of ananda, every degree being 100 times more than the prior ananda. And the point of this text, Taittiriya Upanishad, is to show that the ananda you experience is relative. How much ananda? So if you're going to translate ananda as bliss, you're talking about something that's relative, something that has taratamya. It can be greater, it can be less. Therefore, it's not akanda ananda. Akanda, partless, limitless, full and complete. So here we're differentiating between ananda as an experiential bliss. We're differentiating that from akanda ananda, limitless fullness, which is not an experience. Any experience of bliss can be more, can be less. It can start, it can stop. But akanda ananda is not an experience. There's no more akanda, partless, limitless. There's no more or less, nor does it begin or end. Akanda ananda refers to your true nature, being full, complete, or in common language, that inner divinity. Akanda ananda. Okay, nice reference to the Taittiriya Upanishad. We'll continue.
Tad yuktam akhilam vastu, vyavaharastaranvitaha, tasmat sarvagatam brahma, kshire sarpa ivakhile. Tat yuktam, tat that, referring to Brahman, is yuktam. It is connected to what? Akhilam vastu. Vastu, object. Akhilam, all objects. That Brahman is connected to all objects. Let me just translate the first two lines and then make it more clear. That Brahman is yuktam, connected to all objects. Also that Brahman, the word tat comes again in the middle of the second line. Tat, that Brahman is anvitaha. abides in. Abides in what? Vyavaharaha, in all activities. So tat, referring to Brahman in both the first and second lines, that Brahman is yuktam, connected to all objects, and that Brahman is anvitaha, it is pervading, present in all activities. Now, here Shankara is poetically referring to what is a fairly technical teaching. I shouldn't say technical. A teaching that is said in many, many commentaries. And let me express it the way most commentators say it. They say that Brahman gives satta and spurti to everything. I need to define these two words. Satta, experience. I'm sorry. Satta means existence. I don't know where experience came from. Satta, existence. Spurti, appearance, knownness. Brahman gives existence and knownness to everything that exists. What a beautiful expression. Brahman gives satta and spurti to everything. Brahma gives satta, existence, like clay gives existence to this pot. Brahman gives existence to the cosmos. But further, Brahman gives spurti, knownness, to the universe. How does Brahman give knownness? By giving you consciousness. The consciousness by which you know the world around you, that consciousness is Brahman's manifestation in your mind as consciousness. In this way, Brahman, absolute reality, we've used that word, fabric of existence. But fabric of existence sounds as fabric of existence explains satta. Just as clay is the fabric of existence because of which this pot exists, in the same way Brahman is a fabric of existence because of which the universe exists, that explains satta, existence, doesn't explain spurti. So this pot appears to you and to me. This pot appears due to consciousness. Therefore, that fabric of existence because of which everything exists, we've talked about this before, that fabric of existence is not inert stuff. That fabric of existence is conscious reality. Brahman is the conscious reality that gives existence and knownness to all that exists. That's the meaning of the first line. Brahman is the conscious existence which gives satta, existence, and spurti, knownness, to all that exists. Tasmat, therefore, Brahman is sarvagatam. Brahma is all-pervasive. As that conscious fabric of existence, Brahman pervades the universe. And here Shankara gives an interesting metaphor. Brahman pervades the universe how? And this metaphor is a little bit problematic. Look at it, first of all. He compares Brahman to, in the middle of the last line, sarpihi. Sarpi is one of the name words used for ghee. Ghee, you know, is the fat from milk, the oil or fat in milk. So sarpi, that milk fat is present, eva, sarpihi eva, just like ghee, I'll use the word ghee, just like ghee is present where? Kshire, in milk. Akile, kshire, in all the milk. So if you have a glass of milk, and it has to be whole milk. Nowadays they have the skim milk where they've removed all the fat, so you can't use that as an example. Suppose you have a glass of whole milk. that glass of whole milk has ghee, milk fat, in it. Where's the milk fat? Throughout. It's at the bottom, it's in the middle, it's at the top. It pervades. The milk fat pervades the milk. And here's a metaphor. Just like milk fat, just as ghee pervades milk, in the same way Brahman pervades the universe. Can you see the defect in that metaphor? Pretty easy to see the defect in this metaphor. You can remove the ghee from milk. It's done all the time. Can you remove Brahman from the universe? Can you remove clay from the pot? I'm pointing out the limitation of this metaphor. As I just got done saying, all metaphors have limits. So we have to use the metaphor properly. Here the metaphor is used to describe Brahman as being sarvagatam, all pervasive. And from that context, it's absolutely a perfect metaphor. Milk fat pervades the milk, completely pervades the milk, just as Brahman completely pervades the universe. No problem with the metaphor. Brahman pervades the universe, how? By giving satta, existence, and spurti, knownness, to all that exists. Okay. Next. Ananvastula mahrasvam, ananvastulas ahasram, adhirgamajamavyayam, arupagunavarnakhyam, arupagunavarnakhyam, tadbrahmhetyavadharayet. There's our refrain again. Tadbrahma, that is Brahman. Iti, thus, avadharayet. Thus it should be realized, thus it should be recognized, thus it should be understood. How should Brahman be understood? Go up at the, up to the top. An anuhu a stulam a hraswam a dirgham. I'm stressing the a because most of you know that a negates the words. So Brahman is a or an. Here, an anu. Anu means small. Brahman is an anu, not small. Then the next word, Brahman, is a stula. By the way, the words run into each other. An anu plus a stula becomes ananvastulam. Anyway, just Sanskrit rules. So Brahman is an-anu, not small. Brahman is a-stulam, not large. Brahman is a-hraswam, not short. Brahman is a-dirgham, not long. By the way, if these words are familiar to you, this is a paraphrase of a famous passage in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where the great rishi Yajnavalkya is teaching Gargi. And he uses these very same words. Order is a little different, but Yajnavalkya uses these very same words to teach Gargi the nature of Brahman. So Brahman is neither small nor large, neither short nor long. Further, Brahman is a jam, not born. Brahman is a vyayam. I'm again stressing these as to make the point. You don't pronounce the words like this. Brahman is a vyayam, doesn't decay, undecaying, immutable. Brahman is a rupa guna varna akyam. Brahma is a rupa, has no form. Brahman is a guna, has no qualities. Brahman is a varna, has no, varna can mean color here, has no color. Brahman, notice every one of those words are words of negation, are they not? What was our Arundhati Darshana Nyaya? Not that star, not that star, not that star. In that same Brihadaranyaka Upanishad comes the famous teaching, neti, neti, na iti, na iti, negation. Not this, not this. Not small, not large, not short, not long, not born, not decaying, not having form, not having quality, not having color. Negation, negation, negation. And again, the negation leads you to a discovery, just like that process of negation in the sky led the married couple to discover that particular star that's Arundhati in the same way. Here's another way of understanding. When you negate all that's not Brahman, all that's not Brahman is whatever you experience. Because whatever you experience is limited. Whatever you experience is either tiny or large. It's either small or large. It's either short or long. Everything you experience is born, came into creation. Everything you experience is vyayam, subject to decay. Everything you experience has rupa, guna, and varna, has form and qualities and color. Everything you experience is finite. Limited. So when you negate everything that's finite and limited, when you negate all that you experience, what's left? Can you answer that? You negate all that's finite and limited. You negate all that you experience. What remains is the experiencer, consciousness, your essential nature. That's how this process of negation leads you to discover Brahman, not as an object. The process of negation leads you to discover Brahman as your own true nature. Tad Brahma, that Brahman, iti avadharayet, should be realized. In this manner, Brahman should be discovered to be your own true nature, Atma. And after all, that's what the Mahavakya says, Tat Tvam Asi. Okay, we'll see just one more verse. Yad bhasa bhasyater kadi, yad bhasa bhasyater kadi, bhasyar yat tuna bhasyate, bhasyar yatuna bhasyate, yena sarvamidam bhati, yena sarvamidam bhati, tad brahmet yavadharayeta, tad brahmet yavadharayeta. One more time comes that refrain. In fact, it's the last time we'll see that refrain. Tad Brahma, that is Brahman, iti avadharayet. Thus, in this manner, avadharayet, you should realize, it should be understood, Brahman should be known in this manner. In what manner? Back up the top. Brahman should be known how? Yat bhasa, yat refers to Brahman here. By whose light bhasyate arka adi. Arka, sun, adi, etc. So sun and moon and stars, arka adi. The sun, moon, and stars bhasyate are illumined yat bhasa. By whose light? By the light of Brahman. It's a metaphor. By the light of Brahman, the sun, moon, and stars are known. It's a metaphor. What is being taught there? The sun shines. How do you know? You know the sun shines. You know the moon shines. You know the stars shine. Why? Because you are a conscious being. If you weren't a conscious being, if there were no such thing as a conscious being, which is impossible, if there were no such thing as a conscious being, who would know that the sun shines, that the moon shines? So that consciousness by which you know that the sun and moon shines, that consciousness is Brahman. Brahman's manifestation in your mind as consciousness. So yat bhasa, by the light of Brahman, we said before, Brahman gives spurti, knownness to everything. Brahman gives spurti, knownness to the sun and moon by making you the conscious observer of the sun and moon. So yad bhasa, by the light of Brahman, shining objects like the sun and moon are known, but, and you see, yat tu, in the middle of the next line, tu, but, Brahman is yat, that which na bhasyate, is not illumined, bhasyaihi, by other lights. This is poetry, lovely poetry. Brahman is the light of consciousness by which everything is known, but the light of consciousness at Brahman is not revealed by any other light. Again, light is a metaphor. So light here is metaphorically representing consciousness. The consciousness which is Brahman is not revealed by another consciousness. We discussed this long ago, and we've got this problem of infinite regress. If consciousness is known by consciousness, if consciousness A is known by consciousness B, then consciousness B is known how? By consciousness C. Then how is consciousness C known? By D, etc., etc. Consciousness is not known by consciousness. Consciousness is not revealed by consciousness. Objects are revealed by consciousness. Consciousness need not be revealed by anything. Consciousness is self-revealing. And here, the poetry is nice. So the sun and moon are self-revealing in a relative manner. Consciousness is self-revealing in an absolute manner. Sun and moon, even though they shine, their shining is only known because of consciousness. But the consciousness which is Brahman is not known by any other consciousness, or to stay with the metaphor, Brahman reveals the sun and moon. The sun and moon shine, but they don't reveal Brahman. That's the metaphor. And that metaphor concludes here. Yena sarvam idam bhati. That Brahman is yena. That light of consciousness, yena, by which sarvam idam, all this bhati, shines, the entire universe is known. The entire universe can be known because of consciousness, the consciousness manifest in your mind and my mind, the consciousness which is due to that conscious fabric of reality, of existence, that we call Brahman. This verse is actually a paraphrase of a lovely mantra from, I think it occurs both in the Katha Upanishad and the Mundaka Upanishad. It's a lovely verse that we use at the time of arati. Arati, as you know, is the concluding part of a ritual, puja, in which you show this light to the deity on the altar. And there's some irony in this in this arati. Let me conclude with it. This is lovely poetry and some interesting irony. The origin of arati, of which you may or may not know, is in old times when there were no electric lights inside the temple. You go inside the temple, it's very dark inside. There are just some small oil lamps going, and the oil lamps don't really show enough light for you to see the deity on the altar. The deity is present on the altar, but you can't see the deity clearly because of the lack of light. Then the priest comes with this arati light, usually with this very brightly burning camphor they use. And with that very brightly burning camphor, the priest makes you see the deity on the altar. So the light of that arati lamp reveals God's presence on the altar. And here comes the irony. How can light reveal God? Of course, we're talking about a deity on the altar. Fine. That brightly shining camphor lamp can certainly reveal the deity on the altar. But how can any kind of light reveal the God of the universe, reveal Brahman? So the prayer that's often recited during the arati, as a priest is using that burning camphor lamp to reveal the deity on the altar, oftentimes the priest will chant this particular prayer that focuses on the irony. The prayer, Om Natatra Suryo Bhatina Chandra Tarakam. Tatra, there. There, Chandra Tarakam, Natatra Surya, the sun, moon, and stars cannot reveal Brahman. Now, let me paraphrase a little complicated Sanskrit. The sun, he chants, the sun, moon, and stars cannot reveal Brahman, nor can lightning reveal Brahman. If the sun, moon, and stars and lightning cannot reveal Brahman, then what is the point of this agni, of this lamp that I'm showing to the deity? Nema vidyuto bhanti kuto kutaha ayam agnihi. What's the point of this little lamp I'm shining upon the deity? Tameva bhantam, that God of the cosmos is the one that shines. Tameva bhantam anubhati sarvam. Everything else is revealed by that light of Brahman. Tasya bhasa, by its light, sarvamidam vibhati, similar to the third line here, by the light of Brahman, everything else is revealed. I like this irony. I don't know if the priest is aware of what he's chanting, but I hope you, the next time you go to a temple, if you go to a temple, when that priest is chanting, think about the irony of using a lamp to reveal the deity on the altar is fine. You can use a lamp to reveal the deity on the altar, but no light can reveal Brahman. Brahman is the light of consciousness by which that camphor light is known. That's the irony of arati, of that arati prayer, and Shankara brings it out very nicely in this verse. Okay, we'll conclude here. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, Ma kashchad dukha bhag bhavet, hasato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya,
Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Tat Sat.